yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to shift our focus to the international scene and the international economy. And we're going to talk about what's going on in Europe, as well as some important decisions coming up early next week in that region. And also developments of the past week that will have a relationship on what happens next week and vice versa. Okay, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about this week, two things important economically on a global scale, at least. One is the global bond route that is underway and accelerating. What do I mean by a bond route? I'm talking about bond securities. And what's happening is global bond prices are collapsing as yields, i.e. interest rates for bonds, are accelerating. Bonds, whether they're government bonds or corporate bonds, there is an inverse relationship, of course, between rising interest rates called yields on bonds and declining prices for bonds. As yields rise, the prices collapse. Well, if you're holding bonds and prices are collapsing, that's not so good for your investment, is it? You're losing value on paper quite a bit. The trend is very clear that bond prices are collapsing, and yields, interest rates, are rising. And where we see this happening most aggressively so far is on long-term bonds. In other words, 30-year bonds, 10-year bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds follow the government bonds. Okay, I've talked in the past about how this is a great risk. The bond market is far more important globally and in the U.S. than the stock market. If we have a bond market collapse, bar the door, run away, it will have repercussions that are far more serious than a stock market correction of 10-20%. Okay, and it's beginning to look like we are edging towards a bond market crisis. And certainly, even the business press is talking about bond route, you know. And why do we have the bond market problem? Well, it's because of the rising dollar and rising interest rates, right? Long-term interest rates are rising because the dollar is rising and vice versa, dollar rising as long-term rates rise. This is even before the Federal Reserve begins discussing issues next week, an important development of raising short-term rates. You see, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, has no control over long-term rates. Those are determined by global economic conditions. It can influence short-term rates. And in the past, rising short-term rates would eventually push up long-term rates. But now we got an inverse relationship going on here. It's long-term rates that will be pulling up short-term. In any event, any kind of rate increase is going to have repercussions. And what's driving rates, of course, is some fundamental developments that were beginning to occur before the U.S. National elections. And that is investors and the global elite began to increasingly decide there was a need to move away from monetary policy, central bank policy, because it wasn't working. What's central bank policy in this case? Federal Reserve and Bank of England, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, the key banks. Well, that was, since 2009, rely totally on monetary policy as the recovery, because monetary policy would provide zero interest rates for bankers and the wealthy. They would borrow the money super cheap, made possible by the central bank, and then they would move the money and speculate in stocks and bonds and drive up stock and bond and derivative markets and make huge increases in capital gains profits. And that's what they did for 8 years. The ruling elite decided that they were going to enrich themselves first and foremost, and that's why they relied almost totally on monetary policy to do so. In other words, have the central banks pump all kinds of liquidity, cash, money into the economy, drive interest rates down to zero, and keep them there for 8 years. And that led to all this speculation, capital gains, and so forth. Some of the money didn't go totally into financial asset markets. Some of it went offshore. For a while, emerging markets were booming in China and so forth. So some of the money flowed offshore and went into those economies and into the stock and bond markets in those economies, by the way. For example, private corporate bond borrowing in the emerging markets has totaled over $25 trillion. Dollarized bonds, in other words, dollars. Bonds issued in dollars in Latin America and elsewhere, $25 trillion. Well, where did that money come from? Well, it didn't come from those economies. They don't have a dollar as their currency. Well, it came from the U.S. This money flowed out of the U.S. into those economies, sometimes into developing real asset investment, in other words, real manufacturing, real commodity production, and so forth. But a lot of it also went into the financial markets, you know, in Brazil and Venezuela and places like that, China. Okay, so a lot of the money flowed out and of the country, and a lot of the money flowed in, I'm talking about money provided by the central bank, the Fed, flowed into U.S. Financial asset market, stock and bond markets, with interest rates so low. Okay, now the rates are reversing, so the whole process reverses. In other words, rising interest rates in the U.S., first long-term and now short-term, are causing the money to flow back to the U.S., and that's provoking a major, major crisis in emerging markets. Talk about that a little bit more. So why do we have the bond rates rising? Well, it's the dollar rates that are rising. The U.S. dollar, the value of the U.S. dollar is rising, and interest rates are rising as a result. Well, why? Oh, that's because investors anticipate with Trump we're going to have finally a reversal from this monetary policy focus to fiscal policy. It's called infrastructure spending, right? They see these big opportunities for infrastructure spending. In other words, the elites have decided that monetary policy has run its course. They've got as rich as they could off of it through financial speculation and so forth, and it was beginning to become counterproductive, causing bubbles and instability, and not generating very much real investment and growth. So now they're beginning, and they have been talking about this, some of the more leading elements in the elite, for about a year now, that we have to move to fiscal infrastructure spending. And we saw in the campaign here, election, U.S. election, both Hillary and Trump were committing to infrastructure spending. Hillary had a tepid $250 billion plan over 5 years, about $50 billion a year, which, by the way, is about the amount the U.S. spends on agricultural price supports, you know, for the sugar industry and others, so it's not that big. And Trump has promised $1 trillion, $100 billion a year over 10 years, and infrastructure spending. Well, that's what's behind the boom in the U.S. stock market. You know, it went from less than 18,000 to Dow to well over 19,000 in just a matter of a week or so. Well, there are anticipating opportunities for profits for this $1 trillion in infrastructure spending that's going to happen. Also, the stock market is booming because money is moving out of the bond market with collapsing prices in the bond market and moving into stocks. It's rotating, as they say. Well, you know, that's what's driving up the stock market, the Trump election and the rotation of money out of bonds into stocks. And that's going to continue. Right? Well, what this all represents is an unwinding of the bubble created by the central bank, the Federal Reserve, with its 8 years of zero interest rates, near zero interest rates. At the same time, we have another factor here that's driving up the dollar in bond rates, and that is the decision last week by OPEC to finally make some token cuts in crude oil production, oil supply. You know, as I've talked before on this show, the Saudis and OPEC, particularly the Middle Eastern ones, members, have decided a couple years ago they were going to face off the U.S. oil fracking threat, and they were going to pump supply, greater supply of oil, and drop down the price of global oil, and in doing so, bankrupt the American fracking companies. That was a plan 2 years ago that the Saudis initiated. Well, it hasn't worked so well for the Saudis, you see, because Saudis and OPEC does not have the power and control of global oil prices it used to have. Russia produces as much oil as Saudi Arabia, and we produce almost as much now because of fracking. Well, you have these three big poles globally of oil production, and the Saudis, you know, are only one in three. Well, their OPEC allies add a little bit more to it, but they don't have enough to control the price of oil. They thought they did, and they could drive the U.S. Fracking companies out of business, but the fracking companies rely on technologies, and they cut their costs. They shut down their less efficient wells and figured out ways to pump more economically and cost-effectively from other wells. So the U.S. oil production has not really abated. As you know, there's fewer rigs out there, but the other ones that remain are pumping just as much as they were in the past. So the Saudis have failed, you see, in trying to depress oil prices and drive the frackers out of business. And they finally last week admitted it and saying, okay, we will cut back on some of this oversupply that we're pushing into the global market. And it looks like they may get an agreement of some kind with Russia, but it will be on Russia's terms, you see. Now that it appears globally that oil supply will not continue to grow, the Saudis will cut back, maybe the Russians, global oil prices have risen here, back up into the mid-$50 per barrel range. There was, you know, in mid-40 range. They're not going to go much higher, but the fact that they have risen has had the effect of appearing the global economy is, and the U.S. economy in particular, is recovering, growing, and will grow in 2017 with infrastructure spending and so forth. And what that does is drive up the value of the dollar. Now, driving the value of the dollar isn't good for U.S. multinational corporations in the U.S. that export, you see. It's not so profitable to export when the value of your currency rises. But when the value of your currency rises, interest rates are rising, too. So we have this intersection of three key variables, the U.S. dollar's value, U.S. interest rates, and global oil prices stabilizing and rising a little bit. And all that results in bond interest rates rising and, therefore, bond prices collapsing, i.e., the bond route. Excuse me. All right, so now, what does this have to do with the rest of the world economy? Well, if bond rates are rising and the dollar is rising, then other currencies elsewhere are going to collapse, and they are. In 2013, we had this, what was called the taper tantrum, and that was all about excuse me, all about the emerging markets and the threat announced by the Federal Reserve Central Bank, it was going to raise interest rates. It didn't, but just the threat of it caused a panic in emerging markets and a rise in the dollar and a collapse in emerging market currencies. Now, when your currency collapses, investors in those countries, Latin America, wherever, Turkey, South Korea, etc., what are they going to do? Are they going to hold on to currencies and do business in a country where the currency is collapsing? No, they're not going to do that. They're going to get out of there. They're going to sell their interests and sell that collapsing currency and convert it into dollars, i.e. the money is going to flow back to the U.S. The money that flowed out of the U.S. by the Federal Reserve from 2008 on, because of very low rates, is now flowing back because of rising rates. Now, when the currency collapses in these countries, and you get what's called capital flight, money flowing out, what these countries try to do is to stem the flow by raising their own domestic interest rates. That just slows their economy even more. That's already been slowing and deepens the recession, which you're going to see happen, particularly in Latin America, including those so-called right-wing conservative economies now that have recently pulled off their legal coups, you know, Argentina, Brazil, and so forth. The recessions are going to deepen. And already we're hearing about mobilization of popular mobilizations in Brazil and elsewhere. Now, also, because those countries, emerging markets, import a lot of different kinds of consumer goods and even business goods, right? If their currencies collapse, that means the price of those imports are going to rise. So what you get is a deeper recession, more unemployment and joblessness, and at the same time, rising inflation in those countries. So bottom line, emerging markets economic crisis is about to deepen and deepen rapidly. And I'm talking primarily, you know, about Latin America, some South Asian countries. Turkey is another one where the overlaid on that is political instability and the collapse of the lira in Turkey and so forth. And now we're seeing crises emerge, intensify in India, where overlaid on it, the Prime Minister Modi there did some stupid things about converting currencies and so forth, which only exacerbated the problems and the huge number of non-performing bank loans that exist in India right now, destabilizing the banking system over there. Even in China, we see a move here as the Chinese currency, which is fixed in the band of the dollar, is pushing against that lower level of that band. It cannot be sustained within that band, and China will have to devalue. I've been saying that for a year now. China's doing everything it can to prevent a devaluation, because devaluation means capital flight from China. Wherever you have currency decline, devaluation, you're going to see capital flight. And China is desperately imposing controls to stop capital flight out of China, right? The problem presented itself in, originally when the stock market over there collapsed. We had a problem with capital flight. And now you got a continuing exodus of cash out of those out of China, and China introducing other kinds of solutions here to prevent the legal and illegal movement of money out of China. Right? So you see these crises that are intensified, all because of the rising dollar and rising rates. They're linked together. And oil prices rising in a convergence. We have a convergence going on here. If oil price rises, interest rates rises, rising in the U.S. long-term rates and the dollar rising. Well, how much have long-term rates risen? Well, just in the last couple weeks here, a full percentage point. You know, the 10-year government bond was about at 1.52, and now it's at 2.5. And the 30-year bond, which was almost at 2, is above 3% interest rate. Well, that's incredible. That's an incredible move in a very, very short time. And it portends that, you know, you're going to have more of a move. But basically, you know, ultimately, it's the unwinding of the Federal Reserve's stupid policies of zero interest rates, which were implemented to enrich the investor class in this country and encourage them to pump all their money in capital gains in stock and bond markets and so forth. They made trillions and trillions of dollars, the very rich. And you know, that's why figures show all this capital gains income by the wealthy that has occurred. And I mean trillions and trillions of dollars, as I said before, you know, not just financial speculators and banks, but companies in general in the U.S. have provided $5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts in the last 5 years. $5 trillion. Well, where does that money go? Oh, it goes into financial speculation. The financial asset markets drives up the stock and bond markets. That's what has been happening. Oh, but now it's very clear that the spigot is closing. The free money spigot is closing. And the whole process is beginning to unwind. We can thank the Federal Reserve and central banks globally that follow the Federal Reserve for this unwinding. But in the meantime, the wealthy investors have gotten super, super rich. And now they're shifting away from that policy because they squeezed it for all that they can. And now they're saying, oh, we're going to make money off of infrastructure. Donald Trump. Hmm? And Trump's move to infrastructure will break open, I believe, those elements in Europe, business elements that have been advocating business infrastructure spending increase instead of this similar European Central Bank policy that the U.S. has had, relying totally on the central bank and free money. Next week, we're going to see not only the decision by the Federal Reserve on what it's going to do with short-term rates, but we're going to see the European Central Bank also make a decision whether it's going to continue pumping money into the European economy, the Eurozone, or whether it's going to maybe slow that down and rely on infrastructure spending. But the problem over there is that the European Eurozone, the way it's set up since 1999, it makes it very difficult to engage in fiscal spending. There are limits on fiscal spending. That's part of the agreement. You see, it was set up. The whole Eurozone was set up to favor the banks and to favor monetary policy. And the Germans are at the German bankers are at the heart of that, and they won't let the Eurozone engage in fiscal spending because it will raise deficits, and deficits, will bump up against the rules they have of how much deficit spending, fiscal spending states. Members of the Eurozone can engage in. You see, there are Eurozone rules over there, and country after country is beginning to resist, you see. And when the governments cannot stimulate their economies with fiscal spending because of the Eurozone rules, the economies in Europe, except Germany, languish. And that's exactly what's happened. Stagnation in Europe. You know, my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, the chapter on Europe is called Chronic Stagnation. And that's what we have. You know, you have well over 10% unemployment still going on, probably much more than that. Growth of, you know, less than 1% on, you know, deflation here and there. It's just, you know, 8 years of that. They had a double-dip recession back in 2011-13, and the banking system in Europe has never recovered. You see, they've never really bailed out the banks. And the worst place you see this is Italy, and we're going to talk about Italy and the Italian referendum vote, another important decision coming up next week. All right? Europe is spinning out of control, economically, and now we're beginning to see it occur politically as well, with the rise of these challenging parties on the left in Europe and on the right in Europe. The right doing better than the left. A left populism and a right populism going on in Europe as the midstream, mainstream center-right capitalist parties with this policy of monetary and no fiscal predominating, and the traditional social democratic parties hitching themselves to the banker corporate party wagon as junior partners. You see this everywhere, and that's why social democracy is collapsing in Europe. You know, they've abdicated their role as opposition to conservative corporate parties and joined them. And you see that in Germany. The SPD has joined the party, you know, the mainstream Angela Merkel's party there, CDU. And you see the rise on the right and the far right of parties, and on the left, you know, Die Linke on the left. And you see that in France, too. You see the National Front, right-wing party, very, you know, friendly with Trump and Trumpism. And, you know, you got elections coming up in April, April and May in France. And, you know, I'm going to predict that the National Front, the right-wing party of Marine Le Pen, is probably going to prevail. The elites in France are desperately trying to prepare and counteract that possibility. You know, I mean, the UKIP and right wing of the Conservative Party in Britain prevails with the Brexit vote, and now you have the surprise in the U.S. with Trump prevailing. What you've got is right wing populism and false right wing populism. Trump is false right wing populism. Emerging faster and stronger than left populism. And we're going to see more of this. And in France, you know, Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, is probably the leading candidate there. And you see the center-right party in France there, I think it's called the Republican Party, whatever, putting up a totally new candidate, Fillon, he's talking like Trump, you know. They're moving right in their rhetoric. Doesn't mean they will introduce that any more than Trump will. I just wrote a piece that people may want to find, just to digress a little bit, of interest on my blog, jackrasmus.com, called Taming Trump, How the U.S. Elite Plans to Bring Trump Around from his elements of his right-wing populism on economic issues and tame him. And the means by which they will do this, I discuss. He's already quite in their camp, by the way, when it comes to tax policy and deregulation policy. I think they will bring him around to their camp, the U.S. elites, on trade policy. Maybe at the end of the show I'll talk about it if we had more time. And on foreign policy, you know, those are the four issues that the U.S. elite want to maintain direction, neoliberalism, you might say. You know, they'll bring him around, already brought him around on taxes and deregulation, but they'll bring him around as well, I predict, on trade and foreign policy. What they'll let him do is run amok on right-wing populist social issues like immigration and civil liberties. You know, he's still talking very radical on these issues, on police repression of protests and environmentalist rollbacks and so forth. You know, he will continue appearing radical right populist on these issues to keep his base in that area, but he will attack to the left, center, whatever, on corporate issues. You know, he's going to be a Janus face. He's going to be Two-Face. He's going to he's going to rule in two directions here. And that's why the U.S. press is so confused, you know. Like, what is this guy? You know, he goes left and right, whatever, right? Well, that's his plan, right, to be radical on social issues. I mean, you know, he's already tweeting and talking about people who burn the flag should lose their citizenship, right? And he's going to deport 3 million people, 3 million immigrants, you know, which is about the number that Obama deported. So it's quite possible, you know, three million. Obama deported 2.7 million, the biggest deporter, and Trump's talking about 3 million, you know. And other social issues, you know, he'll bend to Ryan in Congress and go after Medicare and Medicaid, right? So that's how Trump is playing the left and the right. You know, on the trade issue, what do you see with Trump? You see talking down individual companies' plans to offshore, to move jobs offshore, right? We saw Ford Motors, you know, he talked them down. The big talk here this last week is, you know, Carrier Corporation, the furnace AC corporation owned by United Technologies. he, quote, talked them down. Well, he didn't make them back off. He gave them a nice big tax cut plum to keep some of the jobs in the U.S. But, you know, his whole strategy of free trade is to engage in these visible talk shop moves and, you know, point to some saving some jobs, a few jobs, in these events, while the whole matter of, you know, repealing or throwing out free trade agreements like NAFTA is put on the back burner. and he will engage in very slow negotiations and token changes in NAFTA, and free trade will be achieved further, not by multilateral agreements like the TPP, but by bilateral negotiations. He's going to negotiate country by country. But free trade is free trade. Doesn't matter if it's multilateral or bilateral, right? But in the meantime, he'll make it look like he's really a radical on the free trade thing and big visibility confrontations, fake confrontations with corporations like Carrier and Ford. All right, that's his strategy. All right, so the point I was making is that you're going to see a replication of his strategy by center-right corporate parties in Europe, like the French Republican Party, and this guy Fillon. He's going to talk like Trump, but he's going to govern like Trump as well. But it remains to be seen whether Fillon can defeat Le Pen in France. I don't think so. As far as the Socialist Party, the Social Democratic Party, François Hollande just resigned. You know, he's got a approval rating of about 5%. He's destroyed that Social Democratic Party. They don't stand a chance. They're going to get swamped. They're historically finished. And the left parties have not been able to unite in France to provide a true left populism like they have in Italy and in Spain. Right? Podemos in Spain and Five Star Movement. I'm going to talk about Italy and the Italian referendum shortly here. But first, I want to reemphasize and recapitulate that the emerging markets are the focal point of the immediate crisis that has been set in motion by this shift from monetary policy to fiscal infrastructure spending forthcoming in the United States. Right? It's this shift and the unwinding of the bubble caused by the Federal Reserve, that's at the core of the bond route, you know, and overlaid on that is the oil price, and overlaid on that is rising interest rates and the dollar in the U.S. Long-term rates are going to continue to rise. They could be as high as, you know, 30-year bond rates could be as high as 4% here by spring. That's quite possible. Short-term rates could be well over, you know, somewhere around 1-1.5%. Now, you know, just a comment on infrastructure spending, that's supposed to create jobs, but we don't know what he really means, Trump, by infrastructure spending yet. You know, it could be subsidies to construction companies. We'll see. We don't know how many jobs that's going to create infrastructure. You know, will it be long-term projects? Well, and if it's construction, you know, you create jobs, and when the construction project is over, the jobs go away, right? And if it's heavy capital-intensive jobs, it doesn't hire very many people in the process. So we don't know how many jobs this so-called infrastructure spending, and whether it will truly be $100 billion a year or not, is going to create. You know, when Obama came into office in 2009, he had promised in his $840 billion, roughly, Emergency Recovery Act, fiscal acts, you know, about $100 billion in infrastructure investment, right? But these were long-term projects, and some of them haven't even been implemented. So even now, today, 8 years later, nowhere near $100 billion has been spent. And the rest of the Obama program was tax cuts for businesses and subsidies for the states. And that's why we didn't get much of recovery. It was a fake fiscal policy. You know, it wasn't really a true stimulative fiscal policy. The real policy was the monetary policy, the central bank, and we talked about that, drive interest rates down to zero and let the wealthy class, investor class, make huge capital gains by speculating in financial markets. And the idea was, if they got so rich, you know, with all, you know, if we overloaded them with money and profits and investment returns, then maybe some of it would trickle down to the real economy. That was the strategy. Of course, it hardly trickled down. It was drip, drip, not trickle down anymore. You know, fiscal policy is supposed to be trickle down. Well, monetary policy is drip, drip. And it failed. It totally failed, except for the rich, as we've said many times here. Well, now we're moving to fiscal. We're moving to fiscal and stimulus. But the question is, will the infrastructure spending create enough jobs to offset the decline in investment and job creation that will occur because of the rising interest rates, both bonds and short-term, long-term rates? That's the big question. You know, if these rates rise very fast, then the companies that aren't going to be involved at all, you know, with infrastructure spending and investment and job creation, they may end up contracting investment and jobs more and faster than the infrastructure projects create jobs. That's the big question, you see. That's the big economic question. It may not result in big job creation here. That wouldn't be surprising. That would just be another, ruling elite farce and misleading piece of policy ideology, just like we were promised low interest rates would create jobs. They didn't. Well, they created, low-paid jobs. You know, high-paid jobs, manufacturing jobs, kept going overseas, and also high-paid jobs, manufacturing jobs, were gutted as much by the tax cuts of the last 8 years as by free trade. You know, free trade caused a big loss of jobs, no doubt. The carriers, the autos, you know, Fords and so forth, they're just the latest iteration of this. This has been going on for 8 years. The tax cuts passed under the Obama administration, extending the same cuts under the Bush administration, gave great incentives, financial incentives, for companies to replace workers, labor, with new machinery, new equipment. We lost as many high-paying jobs to that tax measure as we did high-paying jobs to free trade. People don't focus on that much. So what do we see with the tax policies coming? Well, we're seeing more of the same. This is a fact. Under Bush, taxes were cut $3.4 trillion, 80% of which go to investors and corporations. Under Obama, his first 2 years, was he come in, his Recovery Act in 2009, $300 billion. It didn't work. At the end of 2010, he passed another additional $800 billion, he and the Republicans, $800 billion in tax cuts. More than half of which was just the extending of the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years to 2012. Right? And then in the end of 2012, he, Obama, and the Republicans agreed to another extension, and more so, once again, amounting to $5 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade. That was the fiscal cliff issue. Remember that? Fiscal cliff? Cliff, well, the economy is going to collapse if we don't extend the Bush tax cuts for 10 more years. Well, they did, right? So, you know, Obama and Bush and Republicans and Democrats have given businesses $10 trillion in tax cuts supposed to generate jobs, but we know that record. Didn't do it. Well, you know, now they're talking about with Trump. Trump's proposal to Congress is, depending how you estimate, somewhere between another $4.3 trillion and $6.2 trillion in tax cuts. Plus, we're going to give this this freebie to U.S. multinationals if they bring back their $2.5 trillion and hoard it offshore. They don't have to pay 35% corporate tax rate. They don't have to pay 10%, see. So that'll be a big boondoggle. And right now, the other big tax boondoggle, tax inversions that tech companies and pharma companies and others are benefiting from, and there was some token attempt to stop this in the last 2 years. Now, big business lobbyists are already working Trump to reverse any efforts to limit tax inversion restrictions, you see. Who are they? Oh, the Business Roundtable, the biggest lobbying group for business, National Association of Manufacturers, American Bankers Association, all of them are already, even before legislation, getting the administration to back off of inversions. And then we'll see this sweet deal where they repatriate $2.5 trillion at 10%, and then they're going to pass the tax cuts on top of that, you see. In other words, open up the spigot of free money fiscally through tax cuts to the wealthy. Before, it was the central bank providing all the free money so they could speculate, right? And now they're shifting to fiscal. So the fiscal shift is not just infrastructure spending, it's big tax cuts coming. Okay. Let's talk about the European crisis here. You know, rising bond rates and the rising dollar is having a big impact. It will continue to have a big impact on Europe, right? Rising dollar means collapsing currencies, both the British pound, right, the Swiss franc, and the euro in the eurozone. But those, you know, the collapsing currency is not resulting in a growth in exports necessarily, because the global economy is slowing down. What it is doing is, once again, if your currency is falling, get your money out of it if you're an investor and put it in a currency that's rising and make a capital gain on foreign exchange currency speculation. Well, that's what's happening. The money is flowing out of Europe, flowing into the dollar, just as it's flowing out of emerging markets in China into the dollar, which drives the dollar up even further, right? Yeah. So, instability in the economy in Europe is coming because of this capital flight out of Europe at a time when the banking system in Europe is also increasingly unstable. We see this, right? Italian banks, $400 billion in non-performing loans, even the big giant Deutsche Bank in Germany in trouble, Barclays Bank and others, RBS in the UK. The banking system is teetering in Europe at a time when political instability will exacerbate the whole issue. You see, this the economic policies have caused the political instability in Europe, and the instability in Europe is now feeding back on the economic instability. What we're going to see next week, I believe on Sunday, is a referendum by Italy. And if that, and I'll talk about that referendum shortly, if that referendum does not pass, and it, all the polls show it will not, then the head of Italian government, Renzi, has promised to resign. Okay, so that means you're going to have another government, another election in Italy. So this referendum vote, and I'll talk about what the details of it are shortly, could lead to a collapse of the Italian government at a time in which the Italian banks are about to collapse. Well, that's certainly going to exacerbate the situation with bad loans and attempts to bail out the Italian banks. Right? Political instability is repercussing on economic instability and vice versa, and the most unstable focus point is Italy right now. And Italy's election on Sunday will tell us. Next week we could have a kind of a crisis beginning to emerge in Italy. Next week we're also going to have a vote in Austria, where the far-right Freedom Party there, which has a lot of Nazi elements in it, gets to have another election because it was narrowly defeated in an earlier election, and under Austrian law, if it's that close, there has to be a revote. It was probably stolen. The election was probably stolen from the Freedom Party. And certainly this time around, it's probably going to win. So, you know, we have a collapse of the government in Italy, quite possibly after this referendum vote, and we have a right-wing government taking over in Austria, and then we have an election in France in April, where the choice is a far-right National Front Party versus the center-right corporate party, Fillon, who's trying to act like he's far-right. He's talking up the far-right talk, you know, as a way of trying to outmaneuver the National Front. So this rapid drift to the right, accelerating, going on in Europe, right? And, of course, it's been given some momentum by Trump's election. You know, Trump has talked to Le Pen and very, you know, friendly and encouraging her and so forth, and he's talking to the conservative right in England, same thing. He's pumping up. He's talking to the conservative right in Hungary, other places. You know, trying to give a push to his compatriot political ideologist over there. But Europe can be very unstable politically and economically over the next 6 months. And if it is, money is going to flow out of Europe. The European economy is going to sink further, could very well fall into another recession. And that outflow of capital is going to boost the dollar still further, because it'll flow to the U.S. And the rising dollar will mean rising interest rates, bond rates in the U.S. as well. So we see, you know, the process set in motion here is going to continue and accelerate. It's gaining momentum. It's gaining momentum. So we need to watch Austria and Italy next week, and after that, France. And I think Netherlands, the right wing, and Netherlands also has a votes coming up. I don't know if they're national, but they're local probably. And Holland, Francois Hollande, you know, the fake social democrat, quote, slash socialist party president, is so weak he decided not to run. He announced yesterday, I'm not going to run. Well, he couldn't get elected with Paris dog catcher right now. And his party, I'm sure, have bounced him out and trying to start all over with some new, fresh candidates, right? This guy has been a real, I mean, he's been worse than Obama in terms of doing something for the working classes in France. In fact, he's been leading the attack on the working classes with a proposals to, quote, reform the labor laws, make it easier to fire people and not hire people, and get rid of unions and undercut collective bargaining and so forth in France. You know, this is socialist government proposing this stuff, socialist in name only. Right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit in time remaining about Italy and the Italian referendum. Italy was a major country in economy in Europe, hit hardest by the double-dip recession in Europe. Right? And the banks never recovered, never been bailed out, and their $400 billion in non-performing loans in Italy right now, and that's probably an underestimate, right? The banks are in trouble. Their stock prices are collapsing, and I mean even big banks, not just the smaller banks, but the big UniCredit bank. And if these banks collapse, if their stock price falls further in a renewed crisis starting next week, contagion throughout the banking system in Europe, which itself is not all that stable. You know, if UniCredit collapses, let's say, or even one of the smaller ones like Monte dei Paschi or something, it could have big repercussions on the total European banking system, right? Now, the president there is a guy named Renzi, a liberal, kind of like Obama, right? Liberal meaning center-right. And he said that if this referendum he's proposed does not pass, he's going to resign. By the way, he's also a major free trade advocate, just like Obama, right? And it's causing him problems with the working class electorate in that country. All the polls show that this referendum is going to fail. The vote was originally scheduled, I think, for October, but they put it off to try to give themselves more time to turn it around, but they're not going to turn it around. What is the referendum on? The referendum is about centralizing political power in Italy. Italy's political structure is very decentralized. You have a House and a Senate, and 315 members in both the House and the Senate. The Senate aren't elected, I believe. And the Senate has blocked a lot of legislation. A lot of reform legislation and so forth. Sounds like the Republicans in the U.S. over the last 8 years, right? Yeah, very similar, right? You have and that's the legacy of a two-house legislature, you see. The corporate and elite and lobbyists get two bites at the apple. If, they lose one of the houses, they maintain control of the other one and they can stop things. Well, that's what's happened here. In the U.S., Republican Senate has now will pretty much now it won't because you got two houses in the U.S. that are Republican. But anyway, you have a problem over there in the Senate, and that has been blocking change. Now, the referendum is designed to centralize government, reduce the Senate from 315 members to 100, but they will still be unelected, you see. There will be selected mayors and members of regional assemblies in Italy that will constitute that second house, the Senate. It's kind of like trying to turn the Italian Senate into a British House of Lords, right? Except it will have some constitutional rights in electing president and so forth, and making constitutional changes and so forth, right? But the problem is most of the people see this as a power play by corporations, right, to eliminate local democracy and give the power, concentrate the power in the central government. And it's not surprising that big multinational and big corporations in Italy are strongly in favor of the referendum. Companies like Fiat and Eni and so forth, multinationals. They want to have control over whatever fiscal spending is coming. They don't want to have to deal with local assemblies and approvals by mayors and so forth. So this is a play to open up infrastructure spending and investment to be decided by corporations, big Italian corporations and European and multinational corporations, right? And the people see it as such. It's an attack on local democracy and centralizing it, so business, big business can grab power and grab contracts. The populist left movement there, Five Star, it's called Five Star Movement, which is challenging the Liberal Party, which is Renzi's party, the corporate party, right, the Social Democratic Corporate Party. Five Star Movement, it's called, right, is opposing this and declaring for a no vote. And it would shoot down the referendum because it eliminates democracy, right? It's an attack on democracy, they're arguing, and it's, you know, a ploy for big corporations and big businesses to give themselves more power so they can bypass local input and engage in these forthcoming infrastructure projects. You know, Renzi has been demanding that Italy, the limits by the Eurozone on deficit spending and fiscal spending be lifted, and he's warned the Eurozone, the Germans, that he's going to ignore that, the limits of the Eurozone as far as fiscal spending is concerned. He's going to do it, infrastructure, right? Well, you got the local governments blocking this. They want to have a say, they want to have a piece of the action, and so forth, and big business in Italy and corporations, multinationals, don't want to deal with that anymore. Right? They want to just go ahead. Well, the polls show that working class, right and left wing, are clearly going to vote no. Also, the polls show that by significant margins, the south of Italy, which is the most depressed economically, is going to vote against this. So it's quite likely that come next week, the referendum will be shut down, and then Renzi will quit. And there'll have to be another election or another process by which they will appoint another government. But that's going to have consequences. You see, it's going to, as I said, reverberate on the Italian bank crisis. It's going to cause more uncertainty. That means Italian bank stocks are going to collapse even further. And it may require a bailout. The euro will collapse more. And Five Star Movement may become the major party in Italy, right? And then we'll see how they're going to try to block the Five Star Movement. Okay, that's the picture in Europe and Italy. Watch it close next week. Watch the Federal Reserve. Watch the European Central Bank. Watch these votes in Italy. They'll tell us what's happening in Europe. Alternative Visions.